I watch my head as I duck under some supports, climbing to a steel grating. We share a cramped platform with a red aircraft beacon. We're at the top, the highest people in the city, on the tip of the tallest building in town.
You're listening to Night Ride. This is Wes Modes, Volume 101, Urban Exploration. Thank you. My friend did it in heels and a skirt, Susan says. Philip and I nod appreciatively. We imagined it could be done with nothing less than ropes and suction cups. We have everything we think we need, which isn't much. We meet her at her office at 5 p.m. to climb the tallest building in town. Timing is critical. At 5:30 p.m., the elevators automatically unlock for the janitors. We ride an elevator to somewhere in the teens. Philip darts around with an imaginary gun drawn, making like a 70s cop drama. The Mission Impossible tune plays in my head. The security lockout stops us at the next bank of elevators. Susan presses the button for the top floor, but it won't take. We've missed our window of opportunity. She darts downstairs while we wait upstairs. In a few moments, she bursts out of the elevator, motioning us to follow. She uses her connections, bluffing one of the security guys. He's just tick-ticked on his computer, she says. Everything's under computer control. She flicks the button for the top floor, and we hurtle upward. The doors open on the top floor, a plush, glass-walled boardroom with the highest view in the city. But we mean to go higher, much higher. We head into the women's restroom through an unmarked door and up a ladder. We snake up another ladder and through a door that reads, Fan Room, Authorized Personnel Only. We emerge in a fluorescently lit room filled with huge ventilation machinery, ducts and humming bright pink, orange, and green machinery. We clamber up another ladder, and what I see takes my breath away. It's a big, big room, large enough for the world's highest game of half-court basketball. The perimeter is studded with floodlights. A steep stairway of switchbacks ascends out of sight. Clusters of floodlights climb the stairs. Philip turns quiet. Susan erupts into jumping jacks of excitement. We begin our climb. Up, 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 up. Looking down from the narrow landing, I watch the floor drop further and further beneath me, and then whack my head on a floodlight above the stairs, on which someone has courteously scrawled, "Watch your head." We arrive at a catwalk near the top and push through a door. Against the wind, we're outside in the blue-skied early evening. We cross a bit of the roof, crunching gravel, and follow Susan up a steel ladder. I watch my head as I duck under some supports, climbing to a steel grating. We share a cramped platform with a red aircraft beacon. We're at the top, the highest people in the city, on the top of the tallest building in town.
easier to get into the factory then. There were lots of doors that were left open on a regular basis. There were huge holes in the cafeteria walls that you could climb on the roof to get into. It wasn't a problem. Now the factory is locked up tight. The reason that they locked it up is pretty simple. It's unsafe now. There are big holes in the roof now because of the big fire, which I will explain. I remember when it happened. In Deseronto, they didn't get radios for the volunteer fire department until the early 90s. Instead, they used an old air raid siren that you could hear from every corner of the town. When I heard it go, I raced to the fire station on my bike. If you were fast, you could beat the firemen to the station, and the factory is only a block away from my house. The fire was started in the number 2 room, which was a big freezer. It was started by a guy whose real name I can't remember. He took a can of gas in the number 2 room, poured it all over the piles of boxes, which contained very odd things like stickers, which said 4x6 or 69 cents, or those plastic things that you poke into the end of corn cobs so you don't burn your hands, lit it, and closed the doors. The room was lined with an odd styrofoam stuff about 3 inches thick, so when it was lit and the doors were closed, the pressure built up and blew the room to bits. The doors were blown open, and a fireball went shooting through a few rooms of the factory. There wasn't much left in the factory that could possibly burn, so it was fairly easy to contain. The fire was put out, and everything was all right after that. We didn't go into the factory much after that. It just wasn't as fun. It was all burnt.
Night Ride is all about the narrative voice. Written as in literature or spoken as in oral history. Human beings traffic in stories. It's the basis of human communication. Let me tell you about my day, or my life, or an urban adventure I once had, once upon a time. Stories are dreamy, they take you to other places, other times, to other lives. Like music, stories transport you outside of yourself. Stories and music and dreams. I'm Wes Modes. Welcome to Night Ride, Volume 101. The subject is urban exploration. I'd say I had to be about 10, 11, or 12. I think my stepbrothers talked me into it. If I would have known the trouble we would have gotten into, I'm not sure that I would have actually done it, but did it I did. We were suburban kids and had lots of time on our hands and didn't necessarily know what the consequences would be of the things we did. You know, about lighting the appliance store on fire, or exploring the trucking company, or going underground in the storm drains. The storm drains seem to dump all the street waste from an entire city into a really scrungy lake in our suburban neighborhood. And there was a very large gate over a very large storm drain, and we worked our way in there with our dime store flashlights. And after a while, it started to seem like, well, maybe we'd get to the end of the tunnel, and that would make it unnecessary to go all the way back through the storm drains, because we were kind of loath to go all the way back and walk all that distance. And pretty soon, our flashlights started flaking out, so it seemed really attractive to try to find the end of these tunnels. Legend had it, according to my stepbrothers, that they went all the way to the ocean, but it wasn't bloody likely. And so we walked and we walked and we walked, and one of our flashlights died, so we were down to two flashlights. And then another flashlight, battery slowly lost power, and we were walking around nearly in the dark with one flashlight. At that point, we started working our way up to these smaller tunnels that would lead to curbside and torturing unlucky pedestrians by yelling at them and telling them we were stuck in the storm drain and then running for it. One kid that we were yelling at says, "Wait there, wait there." So we waited there. I don't know. We were told to wait there. We did. And he went and got an adult. And the adult went and got the authorities. And soon the paramedics came, and then the fire trucks, and then the hook and ladder truck, and then the ambulance, and then pretty soon the news crew was there, and they extricated us from the storm drain, and we made up a story that I stuck with my story, and my stepbrothers immediately caved and revealed that it was a lie, and the police took us home in the back of the squad car, and I said, "Why didn't you stick with the story?" And they said, "Well, you never lie to police, because they know." So they took us home to our house, and that summer had been a kind of rough summer on my mom, because the police had taken us home like two or three other times. And so at the time we had like a big Spanish-style house with a big heavy door with a little window in it, and my mom opens up the window and sees the police, and then she just slams it again. The police had to knock again. Knock, 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 knock. My mom whips open the door. "What now?" So this is the third time we'd been taken home by the police that summer. It was a rough summer for my mom, mostly because of our urban adventuring, our urban exploration. Suburban exploration, I guess, in this case.
few months ago, I was traveling across the country with a good friend of mine, and we were in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we were low-budget traveling, so we were trying to find places where we could camp for free in Santa Fe, and we were wandering and wandering for hours and hours, and we came across an abandoned, what appeared to be an abandoned hospital next to a government building in the center of town, close to the fancy hotels in the center, and we saw on the side of it a squat symbol indicating that the second floor had a good place to squat. So we went around the side of the building and we tried one of the doors, and it was luckily open, and it was daylight at this point and we felt pretty safe, so we opened the door and we walked in, and the fluorescent lights were on their lowest setting and sort of flickering, and we looked down this long hospital hall. It was silent and empty, and there was a thin layer of dust on everything. And as we looked down the hall, we saw boots. There were boot prints going in all the rooms. And we decided to explore. We went to the second floor and found this beautiful room in the front of the hospital that had great sunlight, but was sort of strange because there were old hospital instruments and curtains and a bathroom that worked and footprints everywhere. And we decided we'd stay there that night and that we'd come back later, but first we wanted to explore the rest of the hospital. And as we walked deeper and deeper into this hospital, the lights got dimmer and dimmer, and there got to be more boot prints and more junk and more tools and more locked doors. And when we came back that night, we changed our minds and we slept on a rooftop.
Grail of Minneapolis Draining is a block-sized natural cave attached to the storm drains under 50-story skyscrapers in the middle of downtown. It is known to exist only by its appearance on sewer maps. Those same maps suggest several routes that might connect to the appropriate tunnel. After years of searching, my friends and I eliminated all routes but one. The entrance is a small gap of air in a cement wall on the river next to downtown, in a very public, visible place, allowing only nighttime expeditions. The tunnel's entry is initially about 3 meters wide and 20 centimeters high. After 20 meters, the tunnel opens up into a room with a high ceiling, then passes into a 4-meter diameter tunnel, filled with 3.9 meters of water, leaving very little room to breathe. Over the course of a year, dozens of attempts were made to enter the tunnel using homemade, ultra-low riding boats, but all failed due to high water, debris, or equipment problems. Finally, this July, we entered without a boat, just by floating ourselves in the dirty river water wearing life jackets. We passed the high-ceilinged room, entered the circular tunnel, and found that after about 100 meters, the tunnel opened up, changed shape, and had several meters of breathing space between the water and the ceiling. We swam for over an hour up the tunnel and managed to cover a kilometer, but became exhausted due to the slight oncoming current. As we swam, we thought of a much better mode of movement, a canoe. A few days later, we had borrowed a canoe, bought a boat license, bought a fishing license, obtained fishing poles for our cover story, drove the canoe down to the river and sunk it. We pushed it underwater through the tunnel and raised it once we reached the tall part of the tunnel. Raising the canoe was difficult, given that the water was several meters deep. The walls were too slippery to hold onto, and the canoe was loaded with rocks, which were needed for the boat to ride low enough to get past the entrance. We did nonetheless raise it, and then paddled easily up the tunnel. Eventually, the water became shallow enough that we were able to anchor the canoe and walk. We walked for hours, reaching many interesting places, including a huge, deafening, 8-meter-high, 6-meter-wide waterfall. To get out before sunrise, we left several major side tunnels unexplored, but within a few days, we were back to finish the job. Unfortunately, it had rained the day before, and where it became shallow enough to walk, the current was unpassable by canoe, by foot, or by swimming. So we turned back. As we got close to the exit, we stopped paddling, sat in the canoe, and relaxed. As the water gently flowed beneath us, we got out our lighting system, ate granola bars, talked, and took photos. After slowly drifting for about 10 minutes, we reached the low ceiling. Here we had to submerge the canoe and float through the narrow clearance of the circular tunnel, just as we had done to get in. For fun, we tipped the canoe and sunk it as we were still in it. It's not every day you get to sit in a sinking canoe. With all the gear packed up and tied down, we sat in the water-filled canoe and proceeded down the circular 4-meter tunnel with 3.9 meters of water. Once we entered the tunnel, our seating order was fixed. I sat in the back, Tom sat in front of me, Clint sat in front of Tom, and Mike sat in the front. As we continued, the water got closer and closer to the ceiling, which was normal, given that the ceiling slips down. This was our 6th one-way trip down the tunnel, so we were comfortable being up to our noses in water. However, the ceiling soon became uncomfortably low, and we didn't know how much more lower it would get. We could see some faint light from outside, so we knew the tunnel was still passable. And for all we knew, this was as low as it was going to get. What really made things difficult was a 17-foot canoe, loaded with bulky gear and rocks. As we went, the canoe would swing around, pushing us against the ceiling, pulling us underwater, or pushing us to the side, which, given the circular shape of the tunnel, was the same as pushing us under. By the time it became really apparent that we should turn back or get out of the canoe, we could no longer communicate such ideas. There was so little air, you had three choices. Put your head upright and see people struggling ahead. Put your head to the side and hear people yelling and swearing and saying they can't breathe. Or put your head back and breathe. To exercise these three options, you had to know which way is up. Since none of us could find their flashlights, except Mike, it was dark enough that it was easy to get disoriented. If you lost your orientation, you would end up breathing in some water. This happened several times to me and several times to others. Also, all the while, we each had to remain as calm as possible. If someone panicked and started choking, there would certainly be nothing anyone else could do to save him. But it was also to be too calm. I remember seeing Tom's head floating motionless in the water, reaching out to find him not responding, and thinking he'd drowned. In the middle of this chaos, the canoe got stuck. It was finally clear to everyone that we should leave the canoe behind. We were in the process of attempting to get out of the canoe when we found that the rope Mike had running to his flashlight, the only flashlight we still had accessible, had gotten tangled around the canoe bars. He tried freeing himself but was unsuccessful, so he pushed the canoe along, just barely moving, knowing that at any moment our last centimeters of air could disappear. After continuing to struggle along, the canoe suddenly hit a pillar in the middle of a tunnel. We knew that this pillar meant we were very near the room with the high ceiling, and that the exit was just 20 meters beyond. Unfortunately, we were still in the low area and could no longer push the canoe. Mike submerged himself and attempted underwater to find his knife and cut the rope. In the process, he lost his knife and the flashlight. Then, still underwater, in complete darkness, he managed to take off his life jacket, untie the rope, and get free. I knew that freedom was near, but the canoe, people, and gear were blocking my way. I had to sit and wait, and hope that my few centimeters of pitch-black reality would continue to exist. With Mike out of the canoe, Clint was also able to get out. Tom, however, was far enough back that he had to dive underwater and swim under the canoe. Somehow he managed to find the room. Finally, with everyone out of the way, we were able to move the canoe around the pillar, and I was able to get into the room.
You're listening to Night Ride. I'm your host, Wes Modes, co-hosts Corey and Riley. Volume 101, Urban Exploration.
There's a tall building in the downtown area of the town I live that I have snuck into a few different ways with friends through resident-only elevators and blocking of doors and some secret passcodes that I don't really remember. And one evening late, we decided that we wanted to somehow climb to the top of this building and view the downtown area in the evening. We had a friend visiting, and we couldn't enter from the main entrance because the main entrance was closed now. It was too late in the evening, so we had no access. So we decided to shimmy up a drain pipe in the rear near a dumpster. I think I climbed up an electrical box and had a hand lift from a friend. Someone else went up a drain pipe, and we ended up on the roof. And the roof was many leveled with different surfaces. And also, residents lived up on the top of the building and had windows, some that faced the roof, we realized later. So we're hopping from roof level to roof level, making probably sounding like giant beasts on the roof of these people's homes, I'm sure. And we could see the rooftops of all the buildings downtown. It was so beautiful. And we decided that we wanted to climb to the very top, up a fire escape stairway or a rail. And we saw the ladder and we're heading towards it. And our, let's see how many pairs of feet, three pairs of feet were heading towards this ladder, and we realize there's a light coming down below our feet, and there's a man's head there. I don't know if he was in the restroom or in his kitchen, but he saw us, and he yelled, "You kids, I'm calling the police! Get off now! Rah, rah!" And then some other things. And we decided to just turn back and run, and somehow we hopped, hop, 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 run, run, skittle, fall, and scurried down the drain pipe, and then we were done. And it was really fun.
Thank you.
You've joined us on a night ride tonight. This, by the way, is volume 101. I'm here with co-hosts, Corey and Riley. I'm Wes. And the subject tonight is urban exploration.